This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Debbie Lerman, it has been, I don't know what, 2 years more since we last spoke. What changed for you?
Can I say everything? what changed for me is that I discovered how things work. So I embarked on trying to figure out why COVID happened the way that it did, because I knew that was wrong. But I didn't know that it was connected pretty much to everything else in the world that was wrong, which is what I discovered and I'm continuing to discover.
What do you think happened with Trump?
I think he knows what happened, and I think he's not allowed to talk about it, and I think he's part of the problem.
What do you mean by that?
Those are my answers. So I think that on, if you don't mind getting into nitty-gritty detail, on March 9th or 10th, 2020, Tucker Carlson went to him, and maybe other people went to him from the National Security Council and other places within the security state, and they told him that this was an extremely dangerous virus that had escaped from a lab, could kill millions of people. Don't worry, we have a solution. We're going to lock everything down and we're going to have a miracle vaccine and you're going to be a savior. So, I mean, any president would, I mean, as we know around the world, everybody said yes. Nobody said no to that. Trump, after a few months, realized that it was crazy to lock everything down. He started tweeting out crazy things like, we must open up. Open up, you know, open the schools, open, and, but he was the president, so it was very strange for him to be tweeting like as if he was some person locked up in their house that was being prevented from going out. And from, you know, he could have just said no more lockdowns because he was the president, but he clearly had no power in that situation. Then he took credit for warp speed, which he still takes credit for to this day, and I think he did that because he's Trump. And because he likes to take credit for things, and he was told that this was the greatest thing on earth. People made billions of dollars. He really likes that. And I also think that there's some legal ramifications. Now, this is complete conjecture on my part, but I think that the PrEP Act, which gives indemnity to everyone who was involved with the vaccines, prevents anyone from coming out and saying, wait, we really actually knew that, you know, it didn't prevent transmission, it didn't prevent infection, you know, we didn't know what the side effects were going to be. I mean, you're not allowed to say any of those things. So, and you have to continue to claim that it's safe and effective, which he does.
When you and I last spoke, you were alluding to the idea that Trump was surrounded, circled, duped. And it's an idea that I found very persuasive. Because not everybody can be ahead of the curve in everything. And Trump is a bit of a blockhead, as you pointed out. And he was quickly surrounded by Deborah Birx, who I'd never heard of until I spoke to you. What happened there?
So Deborah Birx was the representative of the security state who was in charge. Basically, she had more power than Trump. And he knew it, and he resented it. I think he wasn't duped in the sense that, well, he was duped because he wasn't in on the sort of biosecurity cabal international thing that was going on. But he was told something that wasn't true in order for the biosecurity lockdown until vaccine plan to go through. And he knew that Deborah Birx was the one who was enforcing that. He couldn't do anything about it. So in a sense, I don't know if it's him being a blockhead, because I think the same thing happened to Boris Johnson, and I think the same thing happened to the heads of many, many other states who were told the same thing and who went along with it. I actually think Trump probably stopped believing in it before a lot of the other leaders did, and I think he probably realized that it was wrong before they did, but he couldn't really do anything about it. And Deborah Birx was just the face of the national security state that was in charge. She wasn't the one who was making the decisions. As she often points out, it wasn't, you know, she was just the coordinator of the task force. She says that a lot, which is literally that, you know, I mean, that's true. She was the coordinator, but she was also the one who was out front enforcing and disseminating the edicts of the biosecurity cabal.
But she was hired by Matt Pottinger, I think you said, and he's CIA and I think Council for on Foreign Relations.
Yes, right, because that's who was running it. So I now understand, because now it's been a while. So when we first talked, I only knew that Deborah Birx was a very fishy character and that she was appointed by Matt Pottinger and that he was from the National Security Council. I now know that this whole thing was an international scheme, and it was run through the WHO, it was run through the UN, and it was run through NATO, which is really weird. But my guess about why NATO is the sort of one of the coordinating bodies is because they used the NATO mutual defense treaties to get everybody to do exactly the same thing. And as you and I were talking about before we started recording, the response was identical in every country. Every NATO country, every Five Eyes country, so that's the US, UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and I would say South Africa is included in the Anglosphere. I don't know what the treaties are that we have with South Africa, because I know about Five Eyes and I know about NATO, and I don't know what the defense treaties are that we have with South Africa. But in the NATO treaties, one of them has to do with CBRN, which is chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear attacks. And so my assumption is that they defined COVID as a biological weapons attack. That's the only way that they could get NATO involved. I don't think they could say, oh, there's this naturally occurring virus and we need to invoke our NATO CBRN contract or mutual defense agreement. But they could do that if they defined it as a bioweapon attack or bioweapon incident. So that's my guess as to how NATO got involved.
Well, you're creating a great segue into your phenomenal Substack, the Catastrophic COVID Convergence. I love that. Take me through that. Let's go to the start.
Wow. Okay, yeah. Thank you. That's my sort of final statement after over two years of research of what I think happened. So what I think happened, starting all the way back, the Cold War ended, and the Western sort of biodefense industry complex needed to... It wasn't even biodefense, it was just the military-industrial complex needed a different enemy, and so they found terrorism, right? So terrorism became the big boogeyman instead of communism, and 9/11, of course, was the main trigger for that, and so that got lots of funds pouring in for anti-terrorism, and then they had the anthrax attacks, which were shortly after 9/11, and so then all of a sudden, biosecurity, which is defending from bioterrorism and biowarfare, became a huge thing. Now, it was a big it was a thing also even in World War II, because the Japanese and the Germans were both working on bioweapons programs, and we actually imported lots of their scientists after World War II to work on our bioweapons program. And that, if you read RFK Jr.'s book, it's called The Wuhan Cover-Up. I highly recommend it. Anybody who wants to understand COVID really has to read that book, because that book talks about the history of biowarfare and how the money and the power and the organization around biodefense just grew so big in the decades after 9/11 that, in my mind, and as I wrote in the Catastrophic COVID Convergence, COVID was pretty much an inevitable thing. If it hadn't been SARS-CoV-2, they would have found some other virus. And you can tell now that they're looking desperately for some more viruses, because every day we hear about H1N1 or Zika or some other thing that they pull out
Mpox.
Somewhere. Mpox, I forgot. Yeah, Mpox, right. And I read about a new one the other day. I don't even remember the name of it. But they're not really, those aren't flying anymore.
Fauci did try AIDS. Sorry, but he did attempt AIDS in the 80s. I mean, That was his thing.
So AIDS was a thing. I'm not even going to get into that, but the real Anthony Fauci actually gets into that. If you want to read the RFK Jr.'s previous book, which I also highly recommend, gets a lot into the AIDS thing. I have not researched it enough, so I can't speak authoritatively on AIDS. But I can tell you that once they started with biodefense as like, this is where all the money needs to go. Why? Well, the anthrax attacks, which is a little bit ludicrous since it was like a few people got some envelopes and a few people died. It's bad that they died, but it was also traced back to a U.S. bioweapons lab. It's all very fishy, but regardless of that, they also had this theory, and I think a lot of them do believe it, that now that we have the technology, biotech, which they think is a really cool thing, we can, any crazy terrorist in their garage can develop a deadly bioweapon and scatter it all over New York through the subway system or London or something like that. All of which is very fantastical and has never been done or shown that it could possibly be done. But that's the fear. Or they can use it on the battlefield. And in order to protect us from that, they say, not only do we have to make sure that we know what kinds of pathogens could be used in that scenario, make sure we have them too. So dual use in the military sense means that we develop things for both defensive and offensive purposes. And that means that we can develop dangerous pathogens just so we know how to defend ourselves from them, supposedly. It's dual use. Maybe we can use them offensively if we need to. So that's where the bioweapons labs come in. So they're studying these dangerous pathogens. But at the same time, and in the same labs, and the same people, and the same funding, and the same network, they are also studying countermeasures. And countermeasures are the thing that you can deploy as fast as possible to as many people as possible to protect them from whatever the scary pathogen is. And that's where all the money is. So this is where the public-private partnership comes in. And in conjunction with the rise of bioterror as sort of the big money-making military-industrial complex arm, at the same time, there was a huge rise and development of public-private partnerships. And it sounds really, really boring, but that is actually what is destroying the world right now. So a public-private partnership is where the government, which is supposed to serve the people, and the private corporations fuse together. And in the past, that was called fascism. We don't have to call it that. We can call it corporatism. We can call it totalitarianism. There's all kinds of names for it. But what happens is that the public good is now no longer the bodies that are supposed to be serving the public good and that are supposed to be answerable to the public are no longer answerable to the public. And they are now answerable to private interests. And those private interests, as we know, after the fall of the communist bloc, became global interests. So it used to be, national corporations would, of course, use their influence to get laws passed that would be in their favor, and they would use lobbying, and they would use bribes, and they would use all kinds of things. But now that's happening on a global scale. So leading up to COVID, there's a huge global public-private partnership in the biodefense space. And the biodefense space is now no longer just a military counterterrorism space. It's also a huge money-making or potential money-making commercial space where all the pharmaceutical companies are interested in producing these countermeasures. And that involves like lots of academic institutions because you need scientists to do that. It involves scientific publications because you need to put out lots of papers about it. It involves nonprofits that are interested in this area, specifically the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the United States and the Wellcome Trust in England, two of the most giant so-called, I'm calling them nonprofits, but really they're just vehicles for wealth transfer is what they are. And so all of these huge. I mean, it's a huge number, and every one of these entities has. My dog. Can you see him in the background? Do you mind if we pause for a second so
that's
that
fine.
I can? Let's pause for a second. Okay, Junius. So, and the conjunction of that with the public-private partnerships and the public-private partnerships going global. So now we have global public-private partnerships, meaning we have governments that are kind of controlled by or partnering with pharmaceutical companies, NGOs, nonprofits, academic institutions, an enormous conglomerate that all depends on there being dangerous pathogens. If there aren't any dangerous pathogens, there's no reason for any of this to exist. And so they do lots of tabletop exercises where they talk about how dangerous it is, and here are the plans, and here's what we're going to do. And that scares governments into... Yeah, exactly. There's lots of those events that everybody likes to talk about. And rather than... The way that I see those events is, yes, they foreshadowed some of the things that happened during COVID, but the reason that they keep happening is because the biodefense industrial complex has to justify its existence. It has to get more money. It has to get governments constantly scared. So in order to get a government scared, you get them to participate in a tabletop exercise. They say, look, what's going to happen? You know, this scary thing is going to come out of a wet market in China, and it's going to secretly spread around the world, and nobody's going to know until it's everywhere. And then it's going to kill 3% of the people who are infected by it. And that's the story that they made up for COVID. Yeah.
You notice, but it's always China. It's always China.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about China that I think I've been learning, and I still don't know enough about it, but China's part of the global network. They're not our enemy. They are the partner of the other globalists in the global governance plans that are happening, of which COVID was just one manifestation. And it was a manifestation that made me aware of what was going on, whereas before I had no idea. And I think it was possibly a mistake, because I think more people became aware of what was happening than maybe they wanted to be aware at this time.
So there was a big lead up to 2020 is what you're getting at. There was a lot of planning.
Big lead up. And big planning and big, I would say, agglomeration of power and wealth. So when you have, like, really literally hundreds of thousands of people in all these organizations and companies and subsidiaries and government agencies and nonprofits in many, many countries around the world, something has to happen to justify their continued existence. And so COVID was one thing that could have happened. Other things could have happened as well.
And it doesn't matter then who was in office in 2020. If it was Obama, if it was Biden, Trump, doesn't really matter.
Doesn't matter at all. I think it was very convenient for them, actually, that Trump was in office. And I'll tell you why. Because it was the way it was politicized was that Trump... And I think this happened in other countries as well, was that Trump was downplaying it. He wasn't taking it seriously enough. He wanted it to let it rip, and he wanted people to die. And so that made it possible to convert everyone who had Trump derangement syndrome into what I call COVID derangement syndrome. So everybody converted, like, pretty much overnight. It was really scary, because the other thing that the global public-private partnerships do is they have a global censorship and propaganda network. And that's what we really, really need to pay attention to, because they use that network. For instance, during COVID, you might have Australian or British intelligence, military, and nonprofit actors censoring and propagandizing U.S. citizens, right? So that they're not under our direct jurisdiction. And then you would have us doing it to them. And so it's like a cross. They're using, everybody uses each other's services in a global way. Like, we really have to think about these things globally and not just nationally. And that's why Trump was important on a local level to get a lot of people riled up about it. So people who didn't like Trump got really riled up about it, and they thought that masks, and so masks became like an anti-Trump statement instead of a public health measure, and it was very hard to argue against them. And vaccines also became a political statement, and I think that also was used in many countries to get people to agree not to just to the vaccines, but to the vaccine passports and the demonizing vaccine. You're right, not vaccines, you know, the mRNA products.
But now, where do you think Trump stands now? I mean, he's got Bobby Kennedy now, you know, right next to him.
Yeah, I think that he, unfortunately, is in the same place as every other American president has ever been, which is under the thumb of the military-industrial complex and the biosecurity global public-private partnership. So he's in the same place as any other president would have been. Bobby Kennedy, unfortunately, I personally think would be much more effective if he stayed outside the government, because I think what they're doing is they're kind of sucking in the dissenters in order to suck out all of their power. And I think once you become part of the machine, it's much harder to fight against it. I think if Bobby Kennedy were able to bring in hundreds of people, of his own people, which he's not, to actually dismantle the public-private partnerships that have completely destroyed the public health infrastructure in the United States, and maybe by example that could be spread to other countries, but basically, if you don't dismantle the public-private partnership side of it, then you're not doing anything. You can cut, like, so we have Elon Musk saying that he's going to cut $2 trillion, whatever. I kind of laughed when I heard that, because Doge, who cares? So you cut $2 trillion. It's like if you have a cancer all over your body and you cut out, you know, a little part of it that's in your shoulder, you've done absolutely nothing to actually solve the problem. And in fact, you've made it worse, because you're pretending that you're solving it and you're not actually addressing what the problem is. And I think that Elon Musk has too many interests, unfortunately, that are part of the problem. It's great that he allows X to be a little bit more open than other platforms, but on the other hand, all of his business interests are completely and totally engaged in the public-private partnership global scheme of biodefense and just military-industrial complex in general.
I saw this week Vance ran a poll of sorts on X saying, should they hold Fauci accountable? And for me, that's a bit of gatekeeping, because Fauci, although I don't like him and he's not really a good guy, he wasn't really anything. He was just a footman.
That's right. That's exactly right. That is a limited hangout. And every time I've gotten very cynical about government in these past few years, because I never really looked into it too hard. I always thought that the government obviously had my best interests, had my best interests. Not, you know, I mean, of course, there were corrupting influences and there were lobbyists and there were corrupt officials everywhere. But I thought in general, like, the idea of government was to have my best interests in mind. And since I no longer think that, one of the reasons I no longer think that is because when I listen to the hearings that they have, either about, you know, when they question Fauci or when they question EcoHealth Alliance, Peter Daszak, about the grants that were used in the labs where they supposedly made SARS-CoV-2, they never ask the questions. They never ask the questions that need to be asked. So the only thing you need to ask Fauci is, who was in charge of COVID? Because it wasn't Fauci. Who was giving you the orders? And the answer is the National Security Council and the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense. Nobody ever mentions those in any hearings. They only mention NIH, CDC. Those agencies were not in charge of the response. And so Fauci himself, now Fauci is a villain, no doubt. but prosecuting him has no impact.
It's not that important.
No, it's not. Not important.
I said this week, and I mean, ever since I spoke to you last, that's why I said my conversation with you back when, was it 21, 22, I can't remember now. You effectively said that it was, you didn't say it, but I mean, I think it's quite obvious now that the whole thing was a military operation. And I mentioned it this week, and people laughed at me. How can it have been a military operation? But it very obviously was. Why would the Department of Defense have taken control?
Yes, it was a military operation, but it was an international. You have to, when you tell people that, if you want to really, the really not believe a word you're saying, is just tell them it was NATO. Right now, in fact, I'm working on an article. So the Dutch Minister of Health just came out recently and admitted that she just said it. She said that COVID was run by NATO, and that she was following that the Dutch government was following NATO orders. There is a researcher who has been saying that since 2022 in the Netherlands. Nobody listens. But when she says that, and in Germany, we have the RKI leak, which is the leak from the institute that's like the equivalent of the HHS. The institute that's in charge of public health, and it was in charge of supposedly in charge of COVID, the Robert Koch Institute. But in fact, in the leak, it is pretty apparent in that, and I've only seen some excerpts of it, but one of the excerpts is that the person who was giving the orders was a NATO official. So NATO was giving the orders, and NATO, through the military and intelligence alliances that we have, was controlling the entire operation. And the vaccines were ordered, paid for, and developed by the U.S. military and national security state in public-private partnerships with the pharmaceutical companies. I'm almost positive that they intended for the mRNA vaccines to be the only ones that actually came through. That's all they cared about. They didn't, the other ones were just kind of a cover, because they think the mRNA platform is this miracle platform that's going to cure everything, and now they're testing it against everything. It doesn't work against anything, just like it didn't work against COVID. It's super dangerous. Hopefully they'll eventually ban it. Some countries are already moving towards that. But that's, I think, what one of the major goals was, to get that platform out there.
I was just going to ask you now, what do you think was the end game of the military operation?
The end game was to get a platform that could respond to any outbreak, naturally occurring or lab manufactured. So now they've fused everything. So the other thing that I wanted to say about the lead up to COVID is that public health became fused with biodefense. So public health used to be a separate thing. It used to be not very interesting. Any kind of pandemic or epidemic that happened, you would just identify the clusters of cases that happened, and you would treat them, and whatever. You would isolate a few people, like with Ebola, because Ebola is super contagious, but it's also super deadly. You know when somebody has it, you know when somebody's infectious, you don't get near them. That's all you need to know. Then the biodefense industrial complex came with this whole much more lucrative endeavor, which is to protect from bioweapons. So now we have this thing where every germ is a potential bioweapon. That's how they treat it. And the response has to be a military response, because that's how you respond to bioweapons, is you get countermeasures and you give them to all the troops if it's on a battlefield, or you have to get them to the entire world population because this dangerous bioweapon is spreading throughout the entire world. So I think the end game was to get the mRNA platform out there. The end game was also it's not really an end game, because I actually think it's an ongoing game. So it's just a chapter or a phase or an experiment. So a lot of things got rolled out and got tested during COVID. One of them being the propaganda and censorship industrial complex. And I would say the thing that scared me most about COVID was how powerful and effective that censorship and propaganda industrial complex is. And so now they're actually shutting down the internet. I don't know if you've noticed, but the internet is almost getting useless as a source of reliable information.
Debbie, the people next door to us, they all blindly complied. And it blew my mind. I've never seen that ever in my life. Walking your dog, and then they report you to the state, to the police, you know?
That's right. That's why I'm saying it's so terrifying, because it turned people who I love into zombies, meaning like cult. Actually, we call it in my family, we call it cult members. So when you're in a cult, you're told to disassociate from people who don't believe in the cult. You're told that you should be able to sacrifice all your belongings, your money, your children, yourself, your health, your life for the cult. And that's kind of what I feel happened to people. But the fact that the propaganda was able to achieve those ends so easily, I still can't think about it without being, you know, feeling a huge amount of terror that such a huge part of the population can get propagandized so easily. And I think because the internet was too open at the time, and still is, I think that they are madly rushing. I mean, I actually think that the global cabal is behind schedule. The WEF has edicts about how governments need to be enacting all of these censorship laws, and they're trying desperately in Australia. You know, they were on some kind of crazy deadline where, well, they failed with one, so they're going to pass the one about the children. So now you have to have a digital ID in Australia to go on the internet in order to prove that you're 16 years or older. Or maybe they said you don't have to have a digital ID, but maybe you do. I don't know. They're just putting that mechanism in place, like you said. And so that was another end game. And again, not end game, but ongoing game that COVID was a part of, which was to get the internet to shut it down. To shut it down so that it can no longer be used as a source of reliable information. It can no longer be used as a source of connecting people like me and you in the United States and South Africa who notice that something weird is going on and, you know, want to oppose it.
When in doubt, though, come to Africa, because we have a failed state everywhere, and they generally aren't quite as efficient as imposing all of these authoritarian measures as they are in first world countries.
Do you feel like that in South Africa or in the rest of Africa?
Yeah, that's a very good question. South Africa obviously is more advanced than most other African countries, so I think we're probably ahead of the curve for all the wrong reasons. But mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
And the other thing that I'm worried about in terms of Africa is that, I don't know if you're familiar with Whitney Webb.
Mm, I know her quite well.
Yeah, you know Whitney. Mm. So I don't know her personally, but I follow her work very closely and admire her greatly. And one of the things that she's been talking about recently is just the collateralization of nature and the fact that what BlackRock and all of the global cabal is doing is they're going in and they're basically just taking over the entire natural world in developing countries. So I know Yes. She was talking about it in South America, but I'm pretty sure that's happening also in Africa.
In your Convergence article, you speak about unchecked capitalism. What do you mean by that?
So a lot of people get really worked up.
Yes, I can imagine.
I don't have any ideological baggage associated with any words like capitalism or socialism or communism or any other kind of word. They're just words that describe a particular system, economic systems and social systems. I know people are very attached to capitalism because they believe that capitalism is this amazing utopian system that's going to produce freedom and wealth and happiness. And it's not. It can only provide those things in an environment where it works, where the private sector is counterbalanced by a public sector, robust public sector that has the interests of the public in mind. Because What I mean by unfettered capitalism is exactly what has happened with capitalism, and some would argue that it's inevitable. I'm not enough of a political economist to know the answer to this. But if you allow free market, which is what capitalism is, if you allow free markets to run by themselves with no external checks, they will inevitably become monopolies, because there will not be, because the more, it's like the state of nature. The more powerful, there will always be some who are more powerful, some who are stronger, and they will always gobble up the little guys. And if there's no protection for the little guys and there's no balancing pressure on the markets, then exactly what's happened in the world is what would inevitably happen in any case where you didn't have any checks. So after communism ended, basically corporations could just go around the big ones, because there always are bigger ones that are going to just go around buying and destroying all the little ones. And then they become monopolies, and then there's absolutely no protection for consumers. There's no reason for them to even care about consumers. Now, a corporation is only responsible to its shareholders. It's not responsible to the public. So another thing that always amused me was when corporations would say, our mission is to make the world a better place. No, it's not. You don't have any mission. Your mission is to generate profit for your shareholders, and that's fine. That's fine. And that's what you should be doing. But I, as an individual who is not one of your shareholders, needs to protect myself from that, because you don't have my best interest in mind. And that's why unchecked capitalism, I've been asked if I wouldn't mind calling it corporatism, in order to avoid upsetting people who think that capitalism is so great. I don't care what you call it. You can call it unchecked capitalism. You can call it corporatism. It's when free markets stop being free, because inevitably, as in every state of nature where there are no checks on power, the powerful get more powerful, the rich get more rich, and everybody else gets screwed.
You've just reminded me now of that story. Is it called Lord of the Flies?
There is Lord of the Flies, yep.
Yeah, where all those kids end up on an island and they just all end up destroying one another.
That's right. That is a very iconic representation of the state of nature.
Just to add to what you're saying, I had on my podcast John Perkins. And he wrote, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, private company. And he would go around the world duping powerful leaders, governments, into getting into huge debt so that the company that he worked for would make a lot of money. And of course, it was a lot bigger than that. But that's an example of the private sector being very, very abusive.
But it's not abusive if you think about it. So it's really interesting. If you really believe in capitalism and free markets, and if you understand what that means, they're not abusive in the sense of what they are designed. Think about a cougar, okay? A cougar is designed to run fast and kill other animals and eat them. It's not cruel. That's just what it does. That's what it's designed to do. If you want to live with cougars, you might have to put them in cages, or you might have to build yourself protections against the cougar. And if you don't, it's going to eat you. That's not cruelty. That's just what it does. It's the same thing with capitalism and corporations. You can say they're cruel. You can say they're manipulative. That's what they're supposed to do. But what we're supposed to do is protect ourselves against it. And we're supposed to build a society with laws and institutions that are separate from the corporation. And what's happened with unfettered capitalism is because all the money and power get funneled into fewer and fewer individuals and corporations and organizations, you can't resist it anymore. There's no law that can resist it anymore.
In the COVID era, a great example of the public-private partnership scenario is you had the Department of Defense, the military, and then you had pharmaceutical companies.
Exactly. And they've been working together for decades. And when you ask the end game, I mean, the part of the game that was the most important to that particular entity was the vaccines, because for them, you know, that justified all the billions of dollars that they had put into research. It justified all the billions of dollars that they're now asking for from, you know, now the WHO is asking for billions and billions of dollars for its biosecurity plans, and the UN is asking for all these things. And we also are using all of that as an excuse for censorship online because of misinformation. So it's very useful. It's very useful. And again, we can talk about it as being predatory or evil, and we can say that they're trying to destroy us, they're trying to depopulate, because it's true that there is a globalist agenda. But the point is not to think of, I mean, we can think about them being evil and we can try to put them on trial or take individuals and prosecute them and say that they're evil. Yes, some of them are evil. But most of them are just going along with the agenda because it pays their salaries and it pays for their kids' colleges and it pays for their vacations.
Okay, but I've got to go back to your president again. You say just paying the bills, just going along with it. What do you think Trump actually knows now?
I think,
let me add to that. So he talks a lot to Bobby. He's obviously well aware of the very, very strong pushback against warp speed. He must know that thing was a failure, and he must know that he needs to calm down on that rhetoric.
Well, Bobby's not pushing him to. So the problem with getting into power is that in order to get into a position of power, you have to tone it down. And I know the people that are now being proposed and nominated for various positions are the people who have the less overtly extreme positions on things like vaccines, because supposedly that's the way to change things from the inside. I don't know a single time in history when that has actually been the case, where toning it down and getting on the inside actually changed anything. And I think that Bobby talks to Trump and Trump says, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then the next day, Matt Pottinger talks to Trump or Robert Kadlec talks to Trump. Robert Kadlec was one of the people who was in charge of warp speed and who's a huge biodefense guy. Or the Secretary of Defense talks to Trump, or he's put in one of these secret rooms and given the talk that everybody gets. And Trump is extremely, I think, people can manipulate him easily if they have power and persuasion. And so they say to him, yeah, yeah, Bobby, yeah. Yeah, he's that kook Bobby. And so he might, when he's talking to Bobby, say, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then when he's talking to the CIA director, yeah, well, yeah, that Bobby guy, whatever. He can do what he wants with the yellow dye in Cheerios or in cereal, but we're not really going to do anything about the biodefense industrial complex.
Something that really frustrates me, I wonder if it frustrates you too, but I do like some aspects of Trump, and I always have to give that disclaimer because he's now becoming the world's most powerful man, we should probably hold him to very high standards. And a lot of the people that he's selecting are very dubious. They're not very strong characters on anything. And something that frustrates me so much is I constantly see what I call the personality cult, the Trump cultists, as it were, those of diehard Trump supporters. It's all part of the plan. It's all 5D chess. It's all the white hat stuff. It seems to me that they're just kicking the can down the road.
Yeah. And they are playing the game, which now I actually was listening to an interview with Whitney Webb and James Corbett about the election, called hopium. So hopium is hope and opium. So it's what people get for once every 4 years, where they spend months and months campaigning and putting their money and effort and energy into campaigning for this candidate or that candidate of the Uniparty, and then getting all upset or getting all happy when their candidate wins or loses, and feeling like they have some kind of say in anything or some kind of power. And then nothing changes. Everything just continues, and it continues to get worse. I think Trump, if he were able to run the country at all, which he's not, as we know from COVID. I mean, I think what he learned during his first term is that he didn't have the power. And I think that they already tamed him. And you can see from his appointments that that's true. I mean, I was really hoping to see some different appointments than what we got. We did get a new interesting one to the FBI the other day, which is Patel, I forget his first name, who has been very critical, although he was on the National Security Council. Somebody just told me that yesterday, during COVID. So my only hope for this administration, and it's not a big hope at all, is that we will get access to the documents. And I've been on a FOIA battle with the United States government now for about almost 2 years, trying to get the documents that actually show what the plan was for the pandemic and who made that plan. Because it was the National Security Council, you can't FOIA the National Security Council, but it's very hard to get a hold of those. Maybe Patel, who was on the National Security Council, can tell us who was the NATO liaison, who was the liaison to the WHO, you know, where were the centralized plans that were being used? What if Bobby Kennedy opens up some files at HHS? Because HHS is in charge of, underneath HHS is ASPR. ASPR is the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, which is Robert Cadlec, which is where all of the nefarious stuff was happening. Let's get those papers, you know. So for me and you, I think the important thing is getting it out to as many people as possible. So when you tell people that was a military operation and they're surprised, that's upsetting. Because we've been yelling about that for years now. So for us, for people like us, and you probably know Sasha Latipova. I don't know if you've talked to her, but yep. Yeah. So she's been yelling about it for years. Mm-hmm. In different countries, different dissident journalists have been yelling about it for years. But the fact that people still are surprised by it and haven't heard of it means that we still have a lot of work to do.
I'm going to get stoned for this, so I must just quickly put out the disclaimer. I said a few minutes ago that Trump is one of the most powerful people in the world. I know that he's not. I'm only saying that within the context of global leaders, political leaders. But if you have to keep giving an addendum for everything you say, we'll never have a full conversation.
And guess what? Who has been in charge? So if you think about the position that Trump is in as president of the United States and how powerful or not powerful it is, let me just ask you this question. Who has been in charge as the president of the United States for the last 4 years?
Definitely not Biden. And if anybody thinks that Biden was pulling the strings, right, is obviously oblivious to reality. But if it's obvious that he wasn't pulling the strings, how suddenly can it be that Trump will now pull the strings? That doesn't make any sense.
That's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. So you need to really look at the office of the president and look at it. And now I think they're not trying to hide it anymore. That's what scares me also, is that nobody's hiding the fact that that we don't have a president, a functioning president. They're making decisions about wars, about hundreds of billions of dollars going to wars in various countries that are affecting millions and millions of people. And we have no president, we have no commander in chief, and we have no idea who's making those decisions. And so when Trump becomes president, why would he all of a sudden be, in a position of power? I mean, so the thing about Trump is what I appreciate about him is that whatever he hears, like whatever the last person was who told him something, he'll kind of say it.
And he'll write it all in uppercase.
Yeah. So we kind of get a feeling. So it's really interesting because during COVID, everything he said was things that people around him were saying. When they were saying hydroxychloroquine was working, when he said that, it's because people around him were saying that. Then they stopped saying that, so he had to stop saying it. And people were telling him the virus came from a lab, and he said it. And then he said, oh, but I can't tell you who told me that or why I think that. So he would say the truth, and he blurts it out a lot. But then they make him walk it back, or they shut him up or whatever. And so I actually think that this time he's going to be more, unfortunately, controlled than last time, because he understands now how the game is played. And the game is played where he gets to be the president, and maybe he'll be more presidential, however people like to define that word. And I'm not, I'm not endorsing that in any way, but he might be less Trump and more presidential, because now he knows he's a figurehead. And now what he gets to do is go out in the media and be Mr. President of the United States, which I think he enjoys, get all the attention. And I think he might actually be, unfortunately, after everything they did to him at the Department of Justice, after everything they did with Russiagate, with January 6th, all that horrible stuff, I actually think they might have more control over him than ever, even though he knows what's going on.
Debbie, do you think that there is another military operation in the works?
I mean, I think now that the global planning coordinating bodies, the UN and the WHO and the WEF, which are, and NATO, which is basically the United States military industrial complex, have different scenarios. I think they had different scenarios for the election. I think they had different scenarios about whether Trump would get assassinated or not, whether he would get elected or not. I think they had different scenarios for that. So those were operations that were, they're constant operations being planned and either executed or not executed. It's hard to say because you can kind of see the outlines of them, but you don't know exactly which ones they're going to go with. I think the next operation is going to be either a climate emergency that requires the same kinds of lockdowns that we had during COVID, and this is something that I was really worried about. Whitney Webb put it in my mind in one of her podcasts, a cyber pandemic or something like that, where they decide that there's a huge collapse. There's some kind of breach of the banks. Financial institutions, international financial institutions have been breached. We have to shut it down, and we have to shut down the internet. And when we come back up, when we bring it back to you, the people, you will have to log in with your digital ID. You will have to be fully identified and fully surveillable in order to participate in the internet and in order to participate in the financial system. So I think that's the end game. If you want to know the end game is that we all need to be traceable and surveillable the way pretty much the system already works in China. And by the way, Ukraine and Russia, both sides of that conflict, not a lot of people know, are already in the system. So both sides of that conflict already have pretty much the digital surveillance system the same way that they have in China. So that also gives one pause.
Yes, there was a tabletop exercise of sorts regarding the cyber attack. I think it was called Cyber Polygon.
I remember I saw something about a tabletop. I don't know if it was that one. But the scary thing is that NATO added cyber warfare to its treaties. So now a cyber attack against one is a cyber attack against all. If you think about that, when they decide that Iran or China or terrorists or whatever launched a cyber attack against us or against you, against South Africa, against South Africa is not NATO, but, against one of the NATO members, all of a sudden, all of NATO is mobilized. So that's a military operation right there. So anything now can be a military operation, especially in the cyber domain, which is the domain that they really care about right now.
No, we're not part of NATO. We're part of BRICS. And Trump also had quite an aggressive statement this week about BRICS, saying that if BRICS countries want to use the dollar less, he wants to start basically a tariff war.
So what I don't, I'm curious what you think about BRICS, because BRICS, as far as I understand it, is totally on board with the whole globalist agenda.
Yes.
And I think BRICS is actually just a red herring.
Yes, it's a double-edged sword, Debbie. I've got a love-hate relationship with BRICS. I like BRICS because I'm in a country that is an underdog. And when it comes to NATO, any type of counter-resistance should be celebrated, number one, because NATO is very aggressive. But on the other hand, I do know that BRICS falls into the globalist agenda. So it's sort of like that cell phone concept where you know that it can be a very great thing, but it can also be a very dangerous thing. As I said, I've got a love-hate relationship with it. For me, it can go both ways, and it probably will go both ways.
If you think about BRICS, though, Brazil is already a totalitarian as far as free speech, as far as free elections, completely under the globalist control. South Africa, I would say, not terribly independent from that.
No, we're not very. No. We're still very much lackeys of the U.S.
Right. China, they're the model, right? So China's the model. They're not the model of what not to do. They're the model of what the global agenda is. So we have Brazil and China already completely in the system. And then we have India, which is so chaotic.
Great food.
The great thing about India, and I don't know enough about how much they're integrated into the system. It's very hard to integrate them because of how chaotic their country is and how many people are in it. And then we have, we had China, Brazil, South Africa, India. Yeah. So pretty much.
And Russia.
And Russia. Okay. And so Russia, again, seems to be our supposed arch enemy. However, in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, again, both sides are fully integrating into the sort of digital surveillance system. And there are indications, or at least I've seen interviews and I've seen news reports about the cozy relationship that the WEF and the International Monetary Fund and the international sort of financial system have with the Russian leadership and oligarchs. So when we talk about countries now, it's really, really tricky because there's people in those countries and then there's the public-private partnerships that run those countries, and they're not at all the same and their interests are completely don't intersect at all. And so the oligarchs who run Russia, and we know that Putin is one of the richest people in the world because he and his coterie, you know, after communism fell, were able to just suck all the wealth of the country right up into their private interests. So it's hard to talk about Russia.
Yeah. And there is a common thread through all these countries, BRICS and NATO, and that's central banks.
Exactly. Exactly.
We already have an official CBDC here in South Africa. It's not widely used yet, but it has been rolled out.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's scary. Mm. Is there resistance?
I have no idea. I don't know anybody who uses it or talks about it, nothing. But I know that it's there because I have a banking app and it's already telling me about it.
Interesting. And so when you talk about COVID, so the COVID vaccine passports, which now they want, the WHO and the UN are now all about making that an international thing. So like if international travel requires a vaccine passport now all of a sudden, then all of a sudden we can't travel if we don't get whatever it is, whatever crazy thing they want to inject into us. And so that's another one of their rolling goals, is to get that out there. And to get everything that you do dependent on that. So if you guys already have CBDCs, at some point the South African government can say, oh my God, we had just had a huge cyber attack. We got to shut everything down. We're shutting our banks down, everything. Oh, okay. Now we're bringing it back, and now everybody has to be on CBDC.
Debbie, are you hopeful?
Good question. I ask myself that every day. So here's why I'm hopeful. I don't think that the system for global control, however much they want it to work, I think it might not be possible. I think the technology is not where it should, where they think it is. I hope. I don't think a lot of the technology that they talk about even exists. I don't believe in transhumanism. I don't believe in the merging of human and machine. That's just not even possible. They don't know anything about science or biology or life. They know computers. And so people who know computers and think that they can use computers to control humanity, right, which is what they think, and control the natural environment, the human race, maybe they're overshooting a bit. Maybe the hubris and the ignorance, which I think are the two things that characterize them the most, are going to lead to their downfall. Is there going to be huge chaos while that's happening? Probably. My hope is that people will continue to value the things that are most important about being human, which have nothing to do with the computers and the technology, and that's what's going to get us through as a species. I think I wish I could be here in 100 years to see what the world was like. I think it's going to be very different, and I hope it's not going to be this sort of technocratic dystopia. But I have hope, because I think the people who are planning for the technocratic dystopia don't actually have the tools and the ability to do it. That's my hope.
You know what I think? And I'm going to say this so that somebody 100 years from now who finds this video between you and me, yeah. I think that in the way that we look back 100 years earlier at people then, they're going to look at us, but they're going to look at us worse. What an unbelievable bunch of morons they were for allowing all of this. I can't get it out of my head that people were reporting their neighbors for walking their dogs. You know, here, I don't know about in the States, but here in South Africa, back in 2020, we weren't allowed to buy cooked food, cooked chicken, roast chicken, because it was considered pathogenic. We couldn't buy open shoes. It had to be closed shoes if you were buying shoes. How unbelievably Monty Python-esque absurdity is that? It's
ridiculous. It's insane.
And it just blows my mind still to this day that people still think it was a good idea.
Yeah, and that's the propaganda. So yeah, so hopefully in 100 years, the way that we look at the propaganda in the 1930s, let's say, in Europe, that's how people are going to look at the propaganda that our generation had to endure. The problem is that we're still enduring it. And as you probably know, I have the same experience as you. I would be walking in the woods with my dog, and people would be walking with masks in the woods and trying to avoid me and saying to me, mask, 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 you know. And I would say things like, I had all kinds of sayings. I would say, you know, wearing masks outside is the height of idiocy. Like, but you can't reason with cult people. And so hopefully the cult people will be the minority. Do you feel like they're the minority? I don't know.
I don't know either. I do this. I sometimes think that they are the majority, then I think they're the minority, and it depends on how I feel that day. how angry I am at the world.
yeah, me too. That's one thing you can say about Trump, about the election of Trump. So one thing you can say is that if 55% of the voters in the U.S., not the population, but the voters, 55%, more than half, might not be cult members.
Yes, right? And also...
So that's encouraging.
That's very true. And also, by the way... I hate ultra cynicism because I think it makes you a little bit too blackpilled. I think we must always have some positivity. We must always look for silver linings. I do really hope that Trump does try his best to do the right things, because not only will it improve the US, but it'll improve my country and other countries, because the US still dominates. And so whatever happens in the US has a ripple effect on the rest of the world. So I do have that little bit of hope in me. I certainly have more hope in him than I do in Kamala Harris or Biden.
I mean, if I had to choose, I'm unlike you, I don't have a lot of hope in Trump. But I do have hope in the fact that there was a massive rejection of what Biden and Kamala and the Democrats stand for. So that massive rejection, in my mind, is where the hope is. I don't think that the whole...
But Trump doesn't pull the strings,
yeah.
Okay, Debbie, how can I... Well, I know where your work is, but okay, let's assume I didn't know where your work is. How could I follow it?
Sure, it's just Debbie Lerman at Substack. My Substack is called Debbie Lerman Substack. And you can also find my work at brownstone.org. So I write for the Brownstone Institute, and I'm a fellow at the Brownstone Institute. And there's a lot of good stuff there, too. Those are the two places. I'm not on X. I don't do social media. I think we all need to stop with social media.
What do you make of Elon?
Well, like I said... I think that it, like when you said the cult of Trump, there's a cult of Elon, and it's pretty much the same people. I think that he wants to play both sides. I think he wants to be a hero of the anti-establishment, but he is so deeply embedded in the global public-private partnership scheme. So all of his companies have military contracts. All of his endeavors have military aspects. He has tweeted out that the mRNA technology is just software for the body, and that we can just upgrade our software. He sees things the way the tech bros see them, which is absolutely counter-human. It's anti-human. So he has anti-human views that are shared by the entire tech bro culture. I don't trust him at all. I think it's great that he wants to be a hero of the anti-establishment, because that makes him do things that are good for us, right? So he does things that are somewhat helpful in terms of the Twitter files, which he allowed, but then he shut it down before we could get most of the information that we needed. He just gave us a little sliver. Then he allows some freedom on Twitter, but I know a lot of people who are still banned. And we also know freedom of speech, but not of reach. That's one of the sayings of Twitter now, one of their mottos. Absurd. And so I don't trust his, I trust that he wants to be a hero of both sides. And that makes me completely distrustful of his ultimate motives. I also don't think that there can be a billionaire who really understands the rest of us. I actually think that they live in a rarefied atmosphere where they are never subject to adversity. Also, they're never subject to opposition, because nobody actually tells them that their ideas are stupid or wrong, or that what they want to do is bad, because everybody has to be adoring and loving. And I saw his interview with Joe Rogan, and I was very disappointed. Very disappointed. I thought it was super boring. I thought they talked about absolutely nothing. I thought they said nothing that was important or interesting. I think that when the real world comes to Elon, like with his trans child or, you know, other hardships that he actually endures that the rest of us also have to endure, you know, that triggers some reaction, you know. But I think that his prescription for how to fix things necessarily comes from a position of an insider. And the position of an insider is that public-private partnerships are actually the way the world should run. And I think Elon believes that. Because
it's obvious for Elon, though, because SpaceX is in itself a public-private partnership. I mean, his biggest client is the U.S. government.
Precisely. That's what I mean. Not to mention the EVs, which are all just a ridiculous scheme. I mean, it's a completely ridiculous scheme. And so, again, his interests are just enmeshed with the global agenda, unfortunately.
Debbie, the difference between North Korea and the United States is that the one country has a personality cult and the other is North Korea.
Exactly.
It's a very strange time we live in.
So strange. And you know what other hope I have? Or at least when I talk to people like you and friends at Brownstone and other places, is that we are living through an incredibly interesting and fascinating time. As long as I could keep my mind wrapped around that and not get too sunk into, like you said, like the, you know, the downs and the despair and the people turning on us and turning on each other. If we can cling to love, unfortunately, I don't want to be corny, but if we can cling to the things that actually make us human and are not machine and are not technology, if we can cling to beauty and love and nature and art, then I think that at least those of us who cling to that can carry those values forward to the next generation. And that's where I see my role, is carrying forward what I think the most important values are so that some people in the world might still enjoy them.
Debbie Lerman, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.